This is Audible.
Audible.com presents Funny in Farsi, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America. Written and read by Firouzeh Dumas. That's me. Leffingwell Elementary School. When I was 7, my parents, my 14-year-old brother Farshid, and I moved from Abadan, Iran, to Whittier, California. Farid, the older of my two brothers, had been sent to Philadelphia the year before to attend high school. Like most Iranian youths, he had always dreamed of attending college abroad, and despite my mother's tears, had left us to live with my uncle and his American wife. I, too, had been sad at Farid's departure, but my sorrow soon faded, not coincidentally, with the receipt of a package from him. Suddenly, having my brother on a different continent seemed like a small price to pay for owning a Barbie complete with a carrying case and 4 outfits, including the rain gear and mini umbrella. Our move to Whittier was temporary. My father, Kazem, an engineer with the National Iranian Oil Company, had been assigned to consult for an American firm for about 2 years. Having spent several years in Texas and California as a graduate student, my father often spoke about America with the eloquence and wonder normally reserved for a first love. To him, America was a place where anyone, no matter how humble his background, could become an important person. It was a kind and orderly nation full of clean bathrooms, a land where traffic laws were obeyed and where whales jumped through hoops. It was the promised land. For me, it was where I could buy more outfits for Barbie. We arrived in Whittier shortly after the start of second grade. My father enrolled me in Leffingwell Elementary School. To facilitate my adjustment, the principal arranged for us to meet my new teacher, Mrs. Sandberg, a few days before I started school. Since my mother and I did not speak English, the meeting consisted of a dialogue between my father and Mrs. Sandberg. My father carefully explained that I had attended a prestigious kindergarten where all the children were taught English. Eager to impress Mrs. Sandberg, he asked me to demonstrate my knowledge of the English language. I stood up straight and proudly recited all that I knew. White, yellow, orange, red, purple, blue, green. The following Monday, my father drove my mother and me to school. He had decided that it would be a good idea for my mother to attend school with me for a few weeks. I could not understand why 2 people not speaking English would be better than 1, but I was 7, and my opinion didn't matter much. Until my first day at Leffingwell Elementary School, I had never thought of my mother as an embarrassment, but the sight of all the kids in the school staring at us before the bell rang was enough to make me pretend I didn't know her. The bell finally rang, and Mrs. Sandberg came and escorted us to class. Fortunately, she'd figured out that we were precisely the kind of people who would need help finding the right classroom. My mother and I sat in the back while all the children took their assigned seats. Everyone continued to stare at us. Mrs. Sandberg wrote my name on the board, F-I-R-O-O-Z-E-H. Under my name, she wrote I-R-A-N. She then pulled down a map of the world and said something to my mom. My mom looked at me and asked me what she had said. I told her that the teacher probably wanted her to find Iran on the map. The problem was that my mother, like most women of her generation, had been only briefly educated. In her era, a girl's sole purpose in life was to find a husband. Having an education ranked far below more desirable attributes, such as the ability to serve tea or prepare baklava. Before her marriage, my mother, Nazire, had dreamed of becoming a midwife. Her father, a fairly progressive man, had even refused the 2 earlier suitors who had come for her so that his daughter could pursue her dream. My mother planned to obtain her diploma, then go to Tabriz to learn midwifery from a teacher whom my grandfather knew. Sadly, the teacher died unexpectedly, and my mother's dreams had to be buried as well. Bachelor number 3 was my father. Like the other suitors, he had never spoken to my mother, but one of his cousins knew someone who knew my mother's sister, so that was enough. More important, my mother fit my father's physical requirements for a wife. Like most Iranians, my father preferred a fair-skinned woman with straight, light-colored hair. Having spent a year in America as a Fulbright scholar, he had returned with a photo of a woman he found attractive and asked his older sister Sedireh to find someone who resembled her. Sedireh had asked around, and that is how at age 17, my mother officially gave up her dreams, married my father, and had a child by the end of the year. As the students continued staring at us, Mrs. Sandberg gestured to my mother to come up to the board. My mother reluctantly obeyed. I cringed. Mrs. Sandberg, using a combination of hand gestures, started pointing to the map and saying, "Iran, Iran, Iran." Clearly, Mrs. Sandberg had planned on incorporating us into the day's lesson. I only wish she had told us that earlier so we could have stayed home. After a few awkward attempts by my mother to find Iran on the map, Mrs. Sandberg finally understood that it wasn't my mother's lack of English that was causing a problem, but rather her lack of world geography. Smiling graciously, she pointed my mother back to her seat. Mrs. Sandberg then showed everyone, including my mother and me, where Iran was on the map. My mother nodded her head, acting as if she had known the location all along, but had preferred to keep it a secret. Now all the students stared at us, not just because I had come to school with my mother, not because we couldn't speak their language, but because we were stupid. I was especially mad at my mother because she had negated the positive impression I had made previously by reciting the color wheel. I decided that starting the next day, she would have to stay home. The bell finally rang, and it was time for us to leave. Leffingwell Elementary was just a few blocks from our house, and my father, grossly underestimating our ability to get lost, had assumed that my mother and I would be able to find our way home. She and I wandered aimlessly, perhaps hoping for a shooting star or a talking animal to help guide us back. None of the streets or houses looked familiar. As we stood pondering our predicament, an enthusiastic young girl came leaping out of her house and said something. Unable to understand her, we did what we had done all day. We smiled. The girl's mother joined us, then gestured for us to follow her inside. I assumed that the girl, who appeared to be the same age as I, was a student at Leffingwell Elementary. Having us inside her house was probably akin to having the circus make a personal visit. Her mother handed us a telephone, and my mother, who had thankfully memorized my father's work number, called him and explained our situation. My father then spoke to the American woman and gave her our address. This kind stranger agreed to take us back to our house. Perhaps fearing that we might show up at their doorstep again, the woman and her daughter walked us all the way to our front porch and even helped my mother unlock the unfamiliar door. After making one last futile attempt at communication, they waved goodbye. Unable to thank them in words, we smiled even more broadly. After spending an entire day in America, surrounded by Americans, I realized that my father's description of America had been correct. The bathrooms were clean, and the people were very, very kind. Hot dogs and wild geese. Moving to America was both exciting and frightening, but we found great comfort in knowing that my father spoke English. Having spent years regaling us with stories about his graduate years in America, he had left us with the distinct impression that America was his second home. My mother and I planned to stick close to him, letting him guide us through the exotic American landscape that he knew so well. We counted on him not only to translate the language, but also to translate the culture, to be a link to this most foreign of lands. He was to be our own private Rosetta Stone. Once we reached America, we wondered whether perhaps my father had confused his life in America with someone else's. Judging from the bewildered looks of store cashiers, gas station attendants, and waiters, my father spoke a version of English not yet shared with the rest of America. His attempts to find a water closet in a department store would usually lead us to the drinking fountain or the home furnishing section. Asking my father to ask the waitress the definition of sloppy joe or tater tots was no problem. His translations, however, were highly suspect. Waitresses would spend several minutes responding to my father's questions, and these responses, in turn, would be translated as, "She doesn't know." Thanks to my father's translations, we stayed away from hot dogs, catfish, and hush puppies, and no amount of caviar in the sea would have convinced us to try mud pie. We wondered how my father had managed to spend several years attending school in America, yet remained so utterly befuddled by Americans. We soon discovered that his college years had been spent mainly in the library, where he had managed to avoid contact with all Americans except his engineering professors. As long as the conversation was limited to vectors, surface tension, and fluid mechanics, my father was Fred Astaire with words. But one step outside the scintillating world of petroleum engineering, and he had two left tongues. My father's only other regular contact in college had been his roommate, a Pakistani who spent his days preparing curry. Since neither spoke English, but both liked curries, they got along splendidly. The person who had assigned them together had probably hoped they would either learn English or invent a common language for the occasion. Neither happened. My father's inability to understand spoken English was matched only by his efforts to deny the problem. His constant attempts at communicating with Americans seemed at first noble and adventurous, then annoying. Somewhere between his thick Persian accent and his use of vocabulary found in pre-World War II British textbooks, my father spoke a private language. That nobody understood him hurt his pride, so what he lacked in speaking ability, he made up for by reading. He was the only person who actually read each and every document before he signed it. Buying a washing machine from Sears might take the average American 30 minutes, but by the time my father had finished reading the warranties, terms of contracts, and credit information, the store was closing and the janitor was asking us to please step aside so he could finish mopping the floor. My mother's approach to learning English consisted of daily lessons with Monty Hall and Bob Barker. Her devotion to let's make a deal and the price is right was evident in her newfound ability to recite useless information. After a few months of television viewing, she could correctly tell us whether a coffee maker costs more or less than $19.99. How many boxes of Hamburger Helper, Swanson's TV dinners, or Turtle Wax could one buy without spending a penny more than $20? She knew that too. Strolling down the grocery aisle, she rejoiced in her celebrity sightings. Lipton tea, Campbell's tomato soup, Betty Crocker rich and creamy frosting. Every day she would tell us the day's wins and losses on the game shows. He almost won the boat, but the wife picked curtain number two and they ended up with a 6-foot chicken statue. The bad prizes on Let's Make a Deal sounded far more intriguing than the good ones. Who would want the matching Lazy Boy recliners when they could have the adult-size crib and high chair set? My mother soon decided that the easiest way for her to communicate with Americans was to use me as an interpreter. My brother Fashid, with his schedule full of soccer, wrestling, and karate, was too busy to be recruited for this dubious honor. At an age when most parents are guiding their kids toward independence, my mother was hanging on to me for dear life. I had to accompany her to the grocery store, the hairdresser, the doctor, and every place else that a kid wouldn't want to go. My reward for doing this was the constant praise of every American we encountered. Hearing a 7-year-old translate Persian into English and vice versa made quite an impression on everyone. People lavish compliments on me. You must be very, very smart, a genius maybe. I always responded by assuring them that if they ever moved to another country, they too would learn the language. What I wanted to say was that I wished I could be at home watching the Brady Bunch instead of translating the qualities of various facial moisturizers. My mother had her own response to the compliments. Americans are easily impressed. I always encouraged my mother to learn English, but her talents lay elsewhere. Since she had never learned English in school, she had no idea of its grammar. She would speak entire paragraphs without using any verbs. She referred to everyone and everything as it, leaving the listener wondering whether she was talking about her husband or the kitchen table. Even if she did speak a sentence more or less correctly, her accent made it incomprehensible. W and TH gave her the most difficulty. As if God were playing a linguistic joke on us, we lived in Whittier, Whittier. We shopped at Witwoud Plaza, Witwoud Plaza. I attended Leffingwell School, Leffingwell School. And our neighbor was none other than Walter Williams. Despite little progress on my mother's part, I continually encouraged her. Rather than teach her English vocabulary and grammar, I eventually decided to teach her entire sentences to repeat. I assumed that once she got used to speaking correctly, I could be removed like training wheels, and she would continue coasting. I was wrong. Noticing some insects in our house one day, my mother asked me to call the exterminator. I looked up the number, then told my mother to call and say, "We have silverfish in our house." My mother grumbled, dialed the number and said, "Please come right away, goldfish all over the house." The exterminator told her he'd be over as soon as he found his fishing pole. A few weeks later, our washing machine broke. A repairman was summoned, and the leaky pipe was quickly replaced. My mother wanted to know how to remove the black stain left by the leak. "Y'all are gonna have to use some elbow grease," he said. I thanked him and paid him and walked with my mother to the hardware store. After searching fruitlessly for elbow grease, I asked the sales clerk for help. "It removes stains," I added. The manager was called. Once the manager finished laughing, he gave us the disappointing explanation. My mother and I walked home empty-handed. That, I later learned, is what Americans call a wild goose chase. Now that my parents have lived in America for 30 years, their English has improved somewhat, but not as much as one would hope. It's not entirely their fault. English is a confusing language. When my father paid his friend's daughter the compliment of calling her homely, he meant she would be a great housewife. When he complained about horny drivers, he was referring to their tendency to honk. And my parents still don't understand why teenagers want to be cool so they can be hot. I no longer encourage my parents to learn English. I've given up. Instead, I'm grateful for the wave of immigration that has brought Iranian television, newspapers, and supermarkets to America. Now, when my mother wants to ask the grocer whether he has any more eggplants in the back that are a little darker and more firm because the ones he has out aren't right for Khoreshte Bademjoon, she can do so in Persian, all by herself. And for that, I say hallelujah, a word that needs no translation. In the gutter. My father grew up poor in Ahvaz, Iran. His parents died at an early age, brought down by maladies readily cured today. He and his siblings survived through teamwork. And now, even though they are well into their 70s and have many kids and grandkids, they remain the central players in one another's lives. They have supported one another through deaths and illnesses and rejoiced in one another's good fortune. If someone were to ask my father about his proudest moment, he would probably mention the day his nephew, Mohammad, finally bought a house in America, or the day his great-nephew, Mohan, graduated from law school. Telling my father that his beloved older sister, Sedire, is angry with him is like putting a grown man in time out. He just can't stand it. The unbreakable bond between my father and his siblings serves as a testimonial that even though their parents lived very short lives, they did something right. My father's hardscrabble life also left him with a burning desire to get rich. History is full of stories of men overcoming poverty to amass great fortunes in steel or pig farming. Others reach great heights through education, becoming successful doctors and lawyers. My father was an educated man, but as a salaried engineer, he had not a chance of becoming rich, and he knew it. Unwilling to abandon his champagne wishes and caviar dreams, my father dreamed of ways to get rich that required neither hard work nor further education. His dream was that the doorbell would ring and he would answer it. Standing there would be a man in a three-piece navy blue suit who would ask him, "Are you Kazem?" "Yes," my father would answer. Then the man would inform my father that through a series of unbelievable circumstances, he had come into boatloads of money. It was with this mindset that my father decided to enter Bowling for Dollars. In his attempts to embrace American culture, my father had joined the local bowling league. Every Wednesday evening, he would head off to the bowling alley, returning with spellbinding stories about strikes and gutters. Somewhere along the way, he started to believe that he was a gifted bowler. I suspect it had something to do with the American habit of generously heaping praise and encouragement on anyone who tries anything. At some point, someone must have yelled, "Good job, Kaz," which my father interpreted as, "You should go on television and win a fortune." Bowling for Dollars was a game show that merged the fascinating world of bowling with the thrill of Las Vegas. All a contestant had to do to win the jackpot was roll two strikes in a row. The jackpot grew each time a contestant failed to win, taking the excitement up a notch. My parents and I watched the show religiously, with my father's running commentary, which did not resemble that of traditional sports announcers, in the background. My father's comments range from, "You should have gotten that," to, "I would have gotten that." From our sofa, bowling looked easy, and we couldn't understand why so many contestants failed to win the jackpot. At the end of each show, viewers were encouraged to call the studio to become a contestant. My father gathered the courage to call and was invited to come for a trial run. Like a bride preparing to walk down the aisle, my father carefully chose his clothing, got a haircut, and practiced saying, "Hello, I am Kazem," to the bathroom mirror. My mother, now a self-declared bowling expert, gave him all kinds of advice. "Make sure you win." My father drove the hour-and-a-half round trip to the Burbank studio for the first trial run and returned feeling triumphant. He hadn't bowled any strikes, but he had been asked to return for the second practice. If the second practice went well, he would then appear on television. Another hour-and-a-half trip for the second practice, and he was selected to return for a taping of the show. My father was hoping that none of the contestants before him would win, so that the jackpot would be really big. He didn't want to merely win the jackpot. He wanted to win a huge one. The big day finally arrived, and my father was ready to strike it rich. He filled the Impala with gas and set off for the third and final drive to the studio. We waited anxiously at home. My father returned that night looking sadder than I had ever seen him. In his two tries, he had hit a total of only 7 pins, winning $7. He had never before bowled so poorly. He blamed his poor performance on everything from the lights to the long drive. We didn't care why he hadn't won. We just could not recall anybody winning so little on bowling for dollars. My father had spent several times as much on gasoline just driving back and forth to the studio. When the performance was aired a few weeks after the taping, we watched in silence. My father looked very nervous on television, especially after he hit his first gutter ball. After the second gutter ball, he looked positively panicked. After this brush with fame, we no longer watched Bowling for Dollars. We didn't feel the same emotional involvement. Who were we to criticize these people, all of whom managed to win more than $7? Shortly thereafter, my father gave up bowling entirely, deciding it was a stupid sport, if one could even call it a sport. More important, his Wednesday evening bowling nights had forced him to miss the Sonny and Cher comedy hour. Now he was able to squeeze onto the sofa with the rest of us and catch up. Save me, Mickey. When we first came to America in 1972, we knew we would be staying only for about 2 years. This gave us approximately 104 weekends to see everything there was to see in California, from Knott's Berry Farm to Marine World, from the Date Festival to the Garlic Festival. We saw it all. Along the way, we tasted garlic ice cream, date shakes, and cherry slushies, and other foods that we no longer remember, although we do recall the ensuing scrambles to the drugstore for Rolaids. Because we were new to this country, we were impressed not just by the big attractions, but also by the little things, smiling employees, clean bathrooms, and clear signage. Our ability to be impressed by the large selection of keychains at the souvenir shops guaranteed that every place we saw delighted us. There was, however, one attraction that stood apart, one whose sweatshirts we wore with pride, one that generated near religious devotion. Disneyland. My father believed that Walt Disney was a genius, a man whose vision allowed everyone, regardless of age, to relive the wonderment of childhood. Ask my father what he considers to be man's greatest creation in the 20th century, and he won't say computers, the Concorde, or knee replacement surgery. For him, Pirates of the Caribbean represents the pinnacle of man's creative achievement. No matter how many times my father goes on that ride, he remains as impressed as a Disneyland virgin. "Did you see that pirate leg hanging over the bridge? Could somebody remind me that it wasn't real? And the battle between the ships? Geez, was I the only one ready to duck and cover? What kind of man would think of creating something like this? A genius, that's who." I doubt that even Walt Disney's mother felt as much pride in her son as my father did. According to my father, any activity that is enjoyed by our family will be exponentially more enjoyable if shared with others. A crowded dinner at his sister's house, where only half the guests have chairs, is preferred to a meal with four people and ample seating. His tribal nature may result from having grown up with eight siblings, but whatever the root cause, my father decided that if Disneyland was fun for our family, just think how much more fun it would be with 20 other people. That is how, one weekend, we found ourselves at Disneyland's main entrance with six of my father's Iranian colleagues and their families. I had already been to Disneyland 15 times and was, frankly, getting a little sick of the place. I knew every turn in every ride and all the punchlines to all the shows. But nonetheless, on yet another Saturday morning, I stood in front of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride with a large group of people, all oohing and aahing as my father, the self-appointed ambassador to the Magic Kingdom, pointed out fascinating tidbits. See how people wait patiently in these long lines? In other countries, you'd have a fight, but not here. This is America. We roamed through Disneyland like a herd of buffalo, stopping only at the rides deemed worthy by my father. At one point, we found ourselves near the telephones where one could talk to Mickey Mouse. As my father was busy explaining the wonders of the nearby Monsanto ride with the big eyeball that looks positively real, I decided to experiment with the phones, which I had somehow never tried before. I picked up the receiver and discovered that there was no conversation with Mickey Mouse on these so-called phones, just a taped message. Disgruntled, I hung up and looked around to find the rest of the herd. They were gone. One of my father's biggest fears in moving to America was child kidnappings. Our hometown, Abadan, was about as safe a place as one could hope for. We knew all the neighbors, everyone looked out for everyone else's kids, and there was basically no crime other than petty theft. Whenever my relatives came to visit us in America, they would watch the evening news a few times and then refuse to leave the house. "It's too dangerous here," they always said. "Why are there so many shootings?" In Iran, citizens do not have access to guns, so we do not have the types of crimes that so often lead to murders in America. My father was acutely aware of the dangers inherent in our new surroundings and lectured me regularly on the perils of strangers and how I should always go to the police if I ever needed help. There were no police officers in Disneyland, so instead, I opted for the young man in the powder blue jumpsuit wearing the hat that resembled an inverted origami boat. "I'm lost," I told him. "Okay," he said in a kind voice. "Can you tell me what your parents look like?" I told him. "Now, can you tell me what your parents are wearing?" he asked. No 7-year-old, except maybe a young Giorgio Armani, could tell you what his parents were wearing on a given day. After my failure to answer the clothing question, Mr. Polyester escorted me to a small building near the main entrance. This was the Lost and Found, a place that, not surprisingly, I had never noticed during my previous visits. Once I entered the room, I started to cry. Several women surrounded me and asked me my name, which I, in the midst of my mucus-choked sobs, had to repeat several times. "What kind of name is that?" one of them asked. It was as if I was doomed to answer the same questions over and over again for the rest of my life. "I'm from Iran," I sniffled. "How nice," she said. From the look on her face, I could tell she had no idea where that was. Another one complimented me on my English. Then they told me not to worry. I could just sit down here and color while I waited for my parents to come and get me. I continued to cry. The three women tried to comfort me, but by then I had decided to cry the whole time. A few minutes later, the door opened, and in came a screaming boy who looked to be a few years younger than I. As Team Comfort rushed to his side, it became apparent that this boy spoke no English. No matter what the women said to him, he just screamed. When asked his name, he shook his head and cried louder. In desperation, one of the employees turned around and started walking toward me with a big, "I have a great idea" smile on her face. I knew what was coming. "Is that boy from your country?" she asked me. "Why, yes," I wanted to tell her. "In my country, which I own, this is National Lose Your Child at Disneyland Day." "No," I told her, "he's not from my country." I had no idea where the screamer was from, but I knew he wasn't Iranian. A gerbil would never mistake a hamster for a gerbil, and I would never mistake a non-Iranian for an Iranian. Despite the belief of most Westerners that all Middle Easterners look alike, we can pick each other out of a crowd as easily as my Japanese friends pick out their own from a crowd of Asians. It's like we have a certain radio frequency that only other Iranian radars pick up. After a few futile attempts to communicate with the boy, another one of the women came to me and asked me if I could please, in my language, ask that boy his name. I told her that I spoke Persian, and I was certain that the boy did not. The woman then knelt down and got real close to my face, skills picked up during coercion 101. Speaking very slowly, she told me that she needed me to do her a favor. I could tell she was trying to remember my name. She was thinking hard. "Sweetie," she finally said, choosing to sidestep the name like a soldier avoiding a landmine. "Could you just try to talk to him? Will you do it for Mickey?" I wanted to tell her that Mickey was the reason I was lost in the first place. Had I not been trying to talk to him on those so-called phones, I wouldn't be sitting here. I didn't know that rodent anything. I once again told her that I spoke Persian, and I could just tell that the boy could not. "Could you just try?" she pleaded. Just to get rid of her, I walked up to the boy, who, breaking all stamina records, was still crying, and said in Persian, "Shuma Irani Asid, are you Iranian?" The boy stopped crying for a moment, then let out the loudest scream heard since biblical times. Not only was he separated from his loved ones, he was now trapped in the Tower of Babel. Although I was sorry for the little boy, I also felt vindicated. I went back to my coloring book, no longer feeling the urge to cry. I colored a few pages, then lo and behold, in walked my father, looking completely panicked and breathless. He ran and hugged me and asked me whether I had cried. "Of course not," I answered. He told me that I had gotten lost just when the group split in two, so an hour went by before anyone noticed I was missing. "I thought you had been kidnapped," he told me, still out of breath. Timing is key, and I knew this was my moment. "Could we go to the gift shop?" I asked. "Anything you want," he said. "Anything at all." We had to leave Disneyland early that day because my father was too weak in the knees to continue. Even the thought of Pirates of the Caribbean could not revive him. We spent the usual half hour looking for our car in the parking lot. I clutched closely two helium balloons, items my father, prior to this visit, had always called a waste of money and never bought for me, a two-foot-long pencil with scenes from Disneyland, a complete set of miniature plastic seven dwarves with their own carrying case, and a Winnie the Pooh pencil holder. In the midst of my father's newfound appreciation for me, I also asked him if he would take me to the Movieland Wax Museum the following week. "Sure," he said, "anything you want." My father spent the drive home recreating my actions in his absence. "How did you know for sure you were lost?" he asked. "I couldn't see you guys," I answered. "How did you know whom to go to?" he continued. "I looked for someone who worked there." "How did you know he worked there and he wasn't just standing around looking for lost kids?" He had the same outfit as the other six people around him, and he had a name tag. "A name tag, huh? Very clever." I knew what he was thinking. Thanks to Mickey, I had been elevated from child who can't learn to swim to child genius. The following weekend, standing in the Movieland Wax Museum gift shop, I was having a hard time deciding among the visor, the inflatable mini pool with the museum logo, and the deck of cards emblazoned with four different movie stars. Then I heard my father utter the magic phrase, "Why don't we just get all of them?" "Good idea," I said, hoping his newly generous view of useless purchases was more than a passing phase. We left the gift shop with my father holding firmly onto my hand, just as he had done the entire day. Clutching my purchases with my other hand, I basked in my new status as favorite child. Perhaps I did owe that rodent something. Swoosh, swoosh. Every family has a daredevil. In my father's family, the honor goes to Uncle Nematullah, whose daring feat consisted of selecting his own wives three times. Marriage in my culture has nothing to do with romance. It's a matter of logic. If Mr. and Mrs. Ahmadi like Mr. and Mrs. Nejati, then their children should get married. On the other hand, if the parents don't like each other, but the children do, well, this is where sad poetry comes from. As odd as these logical unions may appear to the Western world, their success rate is probably no worse than that of marriages based on eyes meeting across a crowded room and the heart going va, 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 boom. After my uncle's second divorce, he decided to take a break from his medical practice in Ahvaz and come visit us in Whittier. For my American friends, a visiting relative meant a three-night stay. In my family, relative stays were marked by seasons, not nights. No one bothered coming halfway around the world for just the month of December. Might as well stay to experience spring in California, the children's graduation ceremonies in June, and Halloween. It didn't matter that our house was barely big enough for us. My father's motto has always been, "Jobedele," room in the heart, room in the house. As charming as this sounds, it translates into a long line for the bathroom and extra loads of laundry for my mother. My father and his younger brother, Nematullah, share many interests, none stronger than the love of new foods. Some experience a foreign land through museums or historical sites, but for our family, America was to be experienced through the taste buds. Every day, Kazem and Nematullah, like cavemen headed for the hunt, would drive to the local supermarket, returning with cans and boxes of mysterious American products. They picked foods for the pictures on the containers, inadvertently proving that American marketing is sometimes better than American cooking. Since Iranian flavors are quite different from the flavors found in American convenience foods, most of the purchases ended up in the trash can. In Iran, meal preparation took up half of each day, starting early in the morning with my mother telling our servant, Zahra, which vegetables to clean and cut. The vegetables were either grown in our garden or had been purchased the day before. The ingredients in our meals were limited to what was in season. Summer meant eggplant or okra stew, fresh tomatoes, and tiny cucumbers that I would peel and salt. Winter meant celery or rhubarb stew, cilantro, parsley, fenugreek, and my favorite fruit, sweet lemon, which is a thin-skinned aromatic citrus not found in America. There was no such thing as canned, frozen, or fast food. Everything, except for bread, which was purchased daily, was made from scratch. Eating meant having to wait for hours for all the ingredients to blend together just right. When the meal was finally ready, we all sat together and savored the sensuous experience of a delicious Persian meal. Upscale restaurants in America, calling themselves innovative and gourmet, prepare food the way we used to. In Iran, it was simply how everybody ate. As Zahra began frying the onions and vegetables each morning, delicious smells wafted through our house. She and her husband Ali, who was our gardener, lived in a small house on our property. Unlike America, where only the very wealthy have live-in servants, in Iran, even middle-class families employ full-time help. Ali and Zahra were from a small village in northern Iran. With us, they could earn more money than was possible back home. They were very happy, and even though my parents found them another family to live with, no one cried harder than they did when we moved to America. After several weeks of trying every TV dinner, canned good, and cereal, my father and uncle concluded that the only ready-made American foods worth buying were canned chili, ice cream, and Chips Ahoy cookies. The rest, they concluded, was too salty, too sweet, or just plain bad. They next set out to explore the unknown territory of American fast food. We lived near a strip mall well supplied with restaurants, all of which took a similar high-grease approach to cooking. Starting at one end, we ate our way through the mall, skipping only a hot dog place called Der Wiener Schnitzel. The name was unpronounceable, and we had no interest in dogs, hot or otherwise. After weeks of research, we concluded that Kentucky Fried Chicken was the best thing we had tasted in America, followed by Baskin-Robbins, every last one of its flavors. No one was made happier by our foray into eating prepared foods than my mother, who, lacking both Iranian ingredients and Zahra, had a very difficult time cooking in America. The Colonel's secret recipe had set my mother free. Several times a week, my father would buy a couple of buckets of fried chicken on his way home from work. We'd fight over the crispy crumbs at the bottom and wash it all down with Coke. On other nights, we ate pizza, marveling at the stretchy cheese and our insatiable appetite for this wondrous food. A couple of months after my uncle's arrival, he realized that somehow none of the clothes in his suitcase fit him. He had spent the past few weeks wearing his new American wardrobe of t-shirts and sweatsuits, clothes that had stretched with his palate. My uncle spent the morning trying on all his old clothes, putting on a fashion show of sorts. With his pants halfway around his bottom, he hopped around, telling us that these were the same pants he had worn on the airplane 2 months ago. Unable to button his shirts, he sucked in his gut and tried not to exhale. My father tried to help him with the various buttons, zippers, and snaps, which refused to button, zip, or snap. It was no use. My uncle had come to America to forget his marital problems. In a way, he had succeeded. Now he had his weight to worry about. Starting that day, my uncle decided to lose weight. Dragging me along as his interpreter, he and I headed for the Save-On drugstore to buy diet pills and a scale. We came home feeling hopeful. My uncle swallowed a few pills, then took his regular spot on the sofa to watch the game shows. The next morning, he weighed himself, threw out the diet pills, and dragged me once again to the drugstore. This time, we returned with a powder, which was supposed to be mixed with milk and consumed instead of meals. Since we didn't have a blender, he spent hours in the kitchen, stirring vigorously with a fork, trying to smooth the clumps to make his meals bearable. A couple of days of this powdered cuisine, and my uncle actually lost a few pounds. Things were going well until he decided that adding a couple of scoops of Baskin-Robbins improved the flavor substantially. Following my uncle's post-diet celebration meal, he discovered that his attempts at dieting had left him with a few souvenir pounds. With renewed dedication, my uncle turned to Plan B. Our marathon television watching sessions now had a higher purpose. I was to write down the phone numbers for all the products that quickly and painlessly melted away the extra pounds. 10 minutes into Love American Style, and we had our catch. I dialed the number on the television screen and ordered the cure. Waiting for the package to arrive, my uncle was on a frenzied mission. Like a soldier making love for the last time before he goes to war, Uncle Nematullah spent the next few days embracing his favorite American foods one last time, some twice. Knowing the end was near, he began trying foods whose siren song we had thus far ignored: Twinkies, tacos, beef jerky, guacamole, and maple syrup. The package finally arrived. The miracle cure was a stomach girdle. For $19.99, Uncle Nematullah had purchased a scuba diving outfit of sorts that covered only the stomach, the original owner perhaps having been attacked by a school of sharks. The contraption, when worn for days on end, was supposed to train the wearer to eat less while firming the stomach muscles. Getting my uncle's overflowing gut to fit the stomach girdle was a task left to my father. Every morning before going to work, he helped his brother squeeze into his sausage casing, being careful not to trap Nematullah's ample body hair in the zipper. If you ignored the bulging rolls escaping from above and below the stomach girdle, my uncle did look slimmer. But it was hard getting used to his new erect posture, which prevented him from slumping on the sofa with the rest of us. He strolled around the house admiring his new silhouette, pretending that having his organs crushed was somehow enjoyable. But like all forms of self-inflicted pain, the stomach girdle eventually lost its appeal. It may have been the severe cramping after meals, the inability to slouch, or the welt marks on his skin, but either way, the girdle became history. Uncle Nematullah's next shortcut to sveltness consisted of a specially constructed exercise outfit advertised during the newlywed game that promised to help sweat away those pesky pounds. The outfit was constructed of a thick silver material, a cross between aluminum foil and vinyl, something perhaps left over from a failed space mission and purchased at a NASA garage sale. The instructions stated that the outfit had to be worn for 20 minutes before each meal, during which the wearer was supposed to engage in some form of exercise. My uncle decided to speed the weight loss process by wearing his moon suit all day. He thought nothing of circling the block endlessly, leaving neighbors wondering whether perhaps he was looking for the mothership. Dressed for a jaunt on Venus, he strolled to the supermarket, the hardware store, and everywhere else he needed to go. Unable to understand English, he had apparently forgotten the international meaning of stairs as well. Kids at school asked me about the strange guy who was staying with us. In terms of weirdness, my family and I were now off the charts. The state of euphoria brought on by losing a few pounds soon wore off, accelerated perhaps by the annoying stench of stale sweat emanating from the suit. As far as we knew, the suit was not washable. As attached as he had become to his dehydration chamber, my uncle had to admit it was time to get rid of it. A few more hours of TV viewing, and we place an order for the body shaper. This latest gizmo consisted of a nylon cord attached to several pulleys. By attaching the body shaper to a doorknob and lying in the most inconvenient spot possible, the user could exercise one arm or leg, two arms and two legs, one arm and one leg, or any other combination. Perhaps realizing some contortion fantasy, my uncle was completely hooked on the body shaper. He spent his days attached to various doorknobs doing endless leg lifts. Transformed into human scissors, he sliced through the air for hours. We learned the hard way never to open a closed door without first listening for the distinct swoosh, swoosh coming from behind the door. It was a mystery why his latest weight loss gizmo was so successful. We assumed his dedication had something to do with his impending return to Iran and his desire to find a wife. Male peacocks display their feathers to attract the female, but a male human displaying an overflowing gut yields far different results. A month later, with the body shaper having worked its magic, Uncle Nematullah was ready to go home. We watched him pack his suitcases, all of us wishing he could stay longer. My uncle had exercised his way into our hearts, and the house was going to seem empty without him. With a little help from my friends, I was lucky to have come to America years before the political upheaval in Iran. The Americans we encountered were kind and curious, unafraid to ask questions and willing to listen. As soon as I spoke enough English to communicate, I found myself being interviewed nonstop by children and adults alike. My life became one long-running Oprah show, minus the free luxury accommodations in Chicago and Oprah. On the topic of Iran, American minds were tabula rasa. Judging from the questions asked, it was clear that most Americans in 1972 had never heard of Iran. We did our best to educate. You know Asia? Well, you go south at the Soviet Union and there we are. Or we try to be more bucolic, mentioning being south of the beautiful Caspian Sea where the famous caviar comes from. Most people in Whittier did not know about the famous caviar, and once we explained what it was, they'd scrunch up their faces. Fish eggs, they would say. Gross! We tried mentioning our proximity to Afghanistan or Iraq, but it was no use. Having exhausted our geographical clues, we would say, "You've heard of India, Japan, or China. We're on the same continent." We had always known that ours is a small country and that America is very big. But even as a 7-year-old, I was surprised that so many Americans had never noticed us on the map. Perhaps it's like driving a Yugo and realizing that the 18-wheeler can't see you. In Iran, geography is a requirement in every grade. Since the government issues textbooks, every student studies the same material in the same grade. In first grade geography, I had to learn the shape of Iran and the location of its capital, Tehran. I had to memorize that we shared borders with Turkey, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and the USSR. I also knew that I lived on the continent of Asia. None of the kids in Whittier, a city an hour outside of Los Angeles, ever asked me about geography. They wanted to know about more important things, such as camels. How many did we own back home? What did we feed them? Was it a bumpy ride? I always disappointed them by admitting that I had never seen a camel in my entire life. And as far as a ride goes, our Chevrolet was rather smooth. They reacted as if I had told them that there really was a person in the Mickey Mouse costume. We were also asked about electricity, tents, and the Sahara. Once again, we disappointed, admitting that we had electricity, that we did not own a tent, and that the Sahara was on another continent. Intent to remedy the image of our homeland as backward, my father took it upon himself to enlighten Americans whenever possible. Any unsuspecting American who asked my father a question received, as a bonus, a lecture on the successful history of the petroleum industry in Iran. As my father droned on, I watched the faces of these kind Americans who were undoubtedly making mental notes never to talk to a foreigner again. My family and I wondered why Americans had such a mistaken image of Iran. We were offered a clue one day by a neighbor who told us that he knew about Iran because he had seen Lawrence of Arabia. Whoever Lawrence was, we had never heard of him, we said. My father then explained that Iranians are an Indo-European people. We are not Arabs. We do, however, have two things in common with Saudi Arabia, he continued, Islam and petroleum. Now, I won't bore you with religion, he said, but let me tell you about the petroleum industry. Another neighbor, a kindly old lady who taught me how to take care of indoor plants, asked me whether we had many cats back home. My father, with his uncanny ability to forge friendship, said, "We don't keep pets in our homes. They are dirty." "But your cats are so beautiful," our neighbor said. We had no idea what she was talking about. Seeing our puzzled expressions, she showed us a picture of a beautiful, long-haired cat. "It's a Persian cat," she said. That was news to us. The only cats we had ever seen back home were the mangy strays that ate scraps behind people's houses. From that day, when I told people I was from Iran, I added, "Where Persian cats come from?" That impressed them. I tried my best to be a worthy representative of my homeland, but like a Hollywood celebrity relentlessly pursued by paparazzi, I sometimes got tired of the questions. I, however, never punched anyone with my fists. I use words. One boy at school had a habit of asking me particularly stupid questions. One day, he inquired about camels again. This time, perhaps foreshadowing a vocation in storytelling, I told him that, yes, we had camels, a one-hump and a two-hump. The one-hump belonged to my parents, and the two-hump was our family station wagon. His eyes widened. "Where do you keep them?" he asked. "In the garage, of course," I told him. Having heard what he wanted to hear, he ran off to share his knowledge with the rest of the kids on the playground. He was very angry once he realized that I had fooled him, but at least he never asked me another question. Often kids tried to be funny by chanting, "I ran to Iran, I ran to Iran." The correct pronunciation, I always informed them, is Iran. "I ran" is a sentence, I told them, as in, "I ran away from my geography lesson." Older boys often asked me to teach them some bad words in your language. At first, I politely refused. My refusal merely increased their determination. So I solved the problem by teaching them phrases like "man kharam," which means "I'm an idiot." I told them that what I was teaching them was so nasty that they would have to promise never to repeat it to anyone. They would then spend all of recess running around yelling, "Man kharam, man kharam, I'm an idiot, I'm an idiot." I never told them the truth. I figured that someday somebody would. But almost every person who asked us a question asked with kindness. Questions were often followed by suggestions of places to visit in California. At school, the same children who inquired about camels also shared their food with me. "I bet you've never tried an Oreo. Have one." Or, "My mom just baked these peanut butter cookies and she sent you one." Kids invited me to their houses to show me what their rooms looked like. On Halloween, one family brought over a costume, knowing that I would surely be the only kid in the Halloween parade without one. If someone had been able to encapsulate the kindness of these second graders in pill form, the pills would undoubtedly put many war correspondents out of business. After almost 2 years in Whittier, my father's assignment was completed and we had to return home. The last month of our stay, I attended one slumber party after another, all thrown in my honor. This avalanche of kindness did not make our impending departure any easier. Everyone wanted to know when we would come back to America. We had no answer, but we invited them all to visit us in Iran. I knew no one would ever take us up on our offer because Iran was off the radar screen for most people. My friends considered visiting their grandmothers in Oregon to be a long trip. So visiting me in Iran was like taking a left turn at the next moon. It wasn't going to happen. I didn't know then that I would indeed be returning to America about 2 years later. Between frenzied shopping trips to Sears to buy presents for our relatives back home, my mother spent her last few weeks giving gifts to our American friends. I had wondered why my mother had brought so many Persian handicrafts with her. Now I knew. Everyone from my teachers to the crossing guard to the brownie leader to the neighbors received something. "This is from my country, especially for you," she would explain. These handicrafts, which probably turned up in garage sales the following year, were received with tears and promises to write. My mother was particularly sad to return to Iran. I had always assumed that she would be relieved to return to her family and to a land where she spoke the language and didn't need me to act as an interpreter. But I realized later that even though my mother could not understand anything the crossing guard, Mrs. Popkin, said, she understood that this woman looked out for me. And she understood her smiles. Even though my mother never attended a brownie meeting, she knew that the leader, Carrie's mom, opened up her home to us every week and led us through all kinds of projects. No one paid her for this. And my mother knew that when it had been my turn to bring snacks for the class, one of the moms had stepped in and baked cupcakes. My best friend Connie's older sister, Michelle, had tried to teach me to ride a bike, and Heather's mom, although single with two daughters, had hosted me overnight more times than I could remember. Even though I had been the beneficiary of all the attention, my mother, watching silently from a distance, had also felt the warmth of generosity and kindness. It was hard to leave. When my parents and I get together today, we often talk about our first year in America. Even though 30 years have passed, our memories have not faded. We remember the kindness more than ever, knowing that our relatives who immigrated to this country after the Iranian Revolution did not encounter the same America. They saw Americans who had bumper stickers on their cars that read, "Iranians, go home," or "We play cowboys and Iranians." The Americans they met rarely invited them to their houses. These Americans felt that they knew all about Iran and its people, and they had no questions, just opinions. My relatives did not think Americans were very kind. Bernice. In America, I have an ethnic face, a certain immigrant look that says, I'm not Scandinavian. When I lived in Abadan, my mother and I stood out because we looked foreign. Abadan's desert climate, which resembles that of Palm Springs, produces olive-skinned inhabitants. My mother and I, because of her Turkish ancestry, possess a skin color that on Nicole Kidman is described as porcelain, and on others as fish belly white. In Abadan, people always ask my mother whether she was European. Well, she'd always gush, my aunt lives in Germany. When we moved to California, we no longer looked foreign. With its large Mexican population, Whittier could have passed as our hometown. As long as we didn't open our mouths, we looked as if we belonged. But just one of my mother's signature rambling sentences without a verb, "Shop so good, very happy at Sears," and our cover was blown. Inevitably, people would ask us where we were from, but our answer didn't really matter. One mention of our homeland, and people would get that uncomfortable smile on their face that says, "How nice, where the heck is that?" In 1976, my father's new job took us to Newport Beach, a coastal town where everyone is blonde and sails. There, we stood out like a bunch of Middle Eastern immigrants in a town where everyone is blonde and sails. People rarely asked us where we were from, because in Newport Beach, the rule of thumb was, if not blonde, then Mexican. People would ask me things like, "Could you please tell Lupe that she doesn't have to clean our house next week since we're going to be on vacation?" One would think that the inhabitants of Newport Beach, a town 2 hours from the Mexican border, would speak at least a few words of Spanish. But in a place where one's tan is a legitimate topic of conversation, "Is that from last weekend at the beach?" "No, I got this playing tennis yesterday." Learning the language of the domestic help is not a priority. During my first year in Newport Beach, my junior high was conducting mandatory scoliosis checks. all the sixth graders were herded into the gym where we waited for the nurses to check the curvature in our backs. When it came my turn, the nurse took a long look at my face and said, "Oh my God, are you Alaskan?"
"No, I'm Iranian," I replied.
"No way," she shrieked. "Bernice, doesn't this one look Alaskan?" As Bernice